Hello and welcome to Distillations, the science, culture, and history podcast. I'm Michal Maya, a historian of science and editor of Distillations magazine here at CHF, the Chemical Heritage Foundation.
And I'm Bob Kenworthy, CHF's in-house chemist. Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, are a hot topic right now. And today, we'll talk specifically about genetically engineered plants.
We'll talk about the history of plant breeding, what distinguishes conventional plant breeding from genetic engineering, and whether there's any way to combine organic farming and genetic engineering.
Genetic engineering and organic farming, an unexpected marriage.
First, we'll travel to the corn and soy fields of Iowa, where farmers are committed to growing GMO-free crops, but not because of any personal beliefs.
Then we'll talk to Pamela Ronald and Raul Adamczyk. Pamela is a plant geneticist, and Raul is an organic farmer. They co-wrote Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food. And they're married to each other.
All coming up on Distillations. If you've been to a supermarket in the past several years, you've surely noticed the labels organic, gluten-free, and increasingly, GMO-free.
These labels are, of course, informative, but they're also a license to charge a premium price.
And for that reason, more farmers are deciding to grow GMO-free crops to fill this niche market. Amy Mayer shares the stories of two of these farmers from their fields in Iowa.
Midway between the college town of Ames, Iowa, and the state's capital, Des Moines, there's a tiny community called Alamon. In its center is the grain elevator, with those iconic silos that tower over the rural landscape of the Midwestern Corn Belt. It's where many local farmers, when they're ready to sell a crop, bring the corn and soybeans they've grown on the fields that surround it. Aaron Lehman's fields are within sight of Alamon's elevator, though less than 20 minutes from the big box development of suburban Des Moines. But some of Lehman's soybeans will travel 2 hours to reach a specialty market. These crops were grown from seeds that weren't genetically modified. And with the loud and ongoing debate about GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, in food, Lehman has found a lucrative niche for his GMO-free soybeans.
We found that there were some opportunities to grow non-GMO or conventional soybeans that allowed us to get a little extra premium in the marketplace.
Lehman's decision is all about money, which is kind of ironic because one of the biggest benefits to GM crops is higher yield for growers. You might assume that would mean more profits, and sometimes it does. But the pushback against GMOs has created a demand for non-GMO corn and soybeans, both major ingredients in processed foods. And this small but growing part of the population is willing to pay premium prices for items like GMO-free Cheerios. Lehman says he gets about $2 per bushel more than the market price for regular soybeans. This year, that's about a 20% premium. At this point, you may be wondering just what is the big deal about genetic modification? The answer depends on who you ask. Let's start in the fields. Genetic engineering has given farmers crops that are protected from certain insects, and that can withstand being sprayed with some herbicides. Glyphosate, an herbicide known by its Monsanto trade name, Roundup, kills numerous weeds that used to plague farmers. When Monsanto developed varieties of corn and soybeans that could survive an application of Roundup, aptly called Roundup Ready, they transformed how farmers manage weeds. They no longer had to worry that the herbicides they used to kill weeds would also kill their crops. Lehman remembers when they came on the market 20 years ago.
Before we had Roundup Ready soybeans, the non-GMO soybeans, you had to make a pretty careful selection for which chemical you will need for your fields that have certain types of weeds.
Apply the wrong chemicals and the weeds might get the better of your crops.
Not all chemicals work for every weed until Roundup came around.
This year in the United States, farmers planted about 94% of soybean acres and 92% of corn acres with seeds that have at least one genetically modified trait. That means they have a bit of DNA from some other organism, often bacteria, that will give the crop seed a desirable characteristic. These days, many corn varieties actually contain more than one trait engineered to help the plant survive. They may protect crops from insects, drought, or herbicides, thereby increasing the farmer's yield and profits. Lehman's son makes cheese from these dairy goats, but the family farm doesn't have other livestock. They farm 550 acres of flat, fertile ground here in central Iowa. They dedicate a third of that acreage to organic crops, including corn, soybeans, oats, and hay. By definition, these are non-GMO. But among the remaining acres, Lehman keeps half in non-GMO soybeans that are not certified organic. The rest is just regular genetically modified corn. Lehman tried GM soybeans when they were new, but despite the relative ease of growing them, he stopped when he saw the chance to specialize in the non-GMO type. These can be sold overseas in markets that prohibit GMOs, and in the U.S. to some food companies that need them for products that can one day wear the non-GMO label. That need is increasing as this niche market now exceeds $8 billion a year.
That's what I hear, that these are used for the food market. Now, more than that, I guess I don't know exactly where they go.
As for eating, Lehman says he's pretty agnostic.
Our household has a lot of different things in our refrigerator, from organic products to leftovers from the fast food restaurant.
But unlike Lehman, some consumers are very picky about products containing GMOs. Even though most consumers can't explain what a GMO is, there is this growing sense that they are bad. Why? I asked a handful of shoppers at a big box store in Ames if they pay attention to whether foods contain GMOs.
It's not something like I won't buy it if it has GMOs, but I keep conscious of it.
Why does it matter to you?
I just watch videos on it, and I don't really can't explain it, but I just don't like seeing it in my food.
I probably should, but I don't.
What gives you the sensation that maybe you should?
Well, I just like to know what's in there, and I do look at ingredients.
Samantha Glazer of Chicago and Ben Lamers of Ames are young adults, but older Americans also are getting messages about GMOs, though Lorraine Bangs of Marshalltown, Iowa, says she doesn't really know what they are.
My daughter keeps after me to read labels. She said, if you can't read what it says on the label and you don't know what it is, you shouldn't buy it.
And retiree George Kalberer says he might shop differently if he had more money.
There's probably real concerns about it, but it was just too pricey.
To understand how consumers developed these vague but negative feelings toward GMOs, we need to turn to the political side of this debate. Megan Westgate is head of the Non-GMO Project, a nonprofit organization created by natural food retailers that developed the Non-GMO Project Verified label to distinguish foods that don't contain genetically engineered ingredients.
The fact is that there are no benefits to the consumer in GMOs, and there's a lot of question marks and potential risks.
Actually, GMOs can take some of the credit for the abundance of cheap food in the U.S. The technology also saved a Hawaiian papaya from a virus that almost wiped it out. Other innovations could help provide much-needed vitamins and nutrients in the developing world, like a controversial type of genetically engineered rice called golden rice, named for its yellow hue, that's fortified with vitamin A. Despite these positive notes, Westgate maintains that consumers want an easy way to identify and avoid GMOs.
There's just a lot of obvious impacts on the environment and increasing data showing that there are health risks, and unfortunately, there really haven't been adequate long-term feeding studies to understand what is the impact on the human body of consuming these products.
Many activists blame the ease of growing GMO crops for the spread of monoculture, the ubiquity of corn and soybeans at the expense of other crops. They say this increases erosion, diminishes the quality of the soil, and contributes to the water pollution related to chemical runoff from farm fields. But the health risk claim is one that many scientists would dispute. There have been hundreds of peer-reviewed published papers looking at genetically modified organisms. Iowa State University sociologist Carmen Bain says the study's consistent findings are reflected in federal regulations.
In terms of the regulations, GMOs are no different than non-GMOs. There is nothing to distinguish them.
In other words, the federal government treats them the same as their non-modified counterparts because it's seen no evidence that they behave differently. Bain says many activists probably know that there's no solid evidence showing any health problems with GMOs in food. But, she says, they use GMOs as a symbol for corporations they think are too big, like Monsanto, or for the preponderance of monoculture. Bain says the public campaign gets oversimplified.
When they're trying to appeal to consumers, it really then focuses on safety issues and like, well, we don't know whether they're safe. Or they focus on arguments around that you should have the right to make these decisions for yourself, that the consumer should make the choice of whether you want to buy these products or not. There should be greater transparencies.
But instead, there tends to be more confusion. And it's not limited to consumers. Steve Kassebaum is a part-time farmer and full-time physical therapist in Nevada, Iowa, about a half hour from where Aaron Lehman farms.
Hey, nice to meet you.
I met with him in a coffee shop on a busy corner in Ame, practically in the parking lot of the local Lowe's and across a busy road from the fire station.
I've been a physical therapist for 26 years, and definitely the patients that I see walk to the door have become increasingly more unhealthy, mainly overweight, deconditioned, and they eat a lot of processed foods. So that got me just thinking about better nutrition and better health.
Kassebaum and his wife recently bought some farmland where they now raise their own meat and grow grains to sell. He's wary of GM food.
I think the verdict's still out about long-term effects of GMO products. And no one's really sure whether it's good or bad for you, but you still wonder.
Kassebaum has the time, money, and curiosity to pay attention to the details of food labels. And since he believes there is doubt, he feels he's playing it safe by keeping one field free of genetically modified crops.
I definitely want to grow as natural and as non-GMO as possible, but yet it's been an investigation on trying to find out all the negatives that surround GMO, but yet also trying to figure out the science.
He says non-GMO may be a better way to go for the land and possibly even for food, but he's also got to make the farm pay for itself, and making planting decisions based on hunches isn't practical. But he's pleased that in his first 2 years, the non-GMO crops haven't hurt his bottom line.
You can still make profits very, very similar, if not as good or better, than conventional GMO crops.
Kassebaum's operation is much smaller than Aaron Lehman's, and he's struggled to find a market for his non-GMO corn. But potential changes in corporate and federal policies could be expanding the market. If pressure from anti-GMO groups continues, they may win over more companies like Chipotle and Ben & Jerry's, which have made public commitments to eliminate GMOs from their products. Sociologist Carmen Bain says the companies are responding to consumer preferences, not science.
This has nothing to do with the safety. You know, we think that they're safe, but this is what consumers want, and so we want to respond to that and give them the choices that they want.
Still, Bain points out that most consumers are more concerned with price than the genetics of an ingredient. But as long as those who care passionately about genetic engineering remain a loud and organized minority, they'll keep a handful of farmers profiting from non-GMO crops. In Ames, Iowa, I'm Amy Mayer.
We're so pleased to welcome our guests, Pamela Ronald and Raul Adamczyk, to the show. Pamela is professor at the Department of Plant Pathology and the Genome Center at the University of California, Davis, and is the faculty director of the UC Davis Institute for Food and Agricultural Literacy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
And Raul is an organic farmer and the Market Garden Coordinator at the University of California, Davis Student Farm. Pamela and Raul co-wrote the book Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food.
Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Good to be here.
So one of the things that I would like to know, what specifically distinguishes an organic plant from a genetically engineered plant? And what might be the benefits of one over the other?
Well, first of all, the difference has been determined by the USDA's National Organic Program, in the sense that any plant that has had genetic engineering done to it, genes brought in from other plants or bacteria or animals, those plants are not allowed to be used in organic farming. So What that leaves are plants that have been bred using traditional plant breeding, as well as hybrids, as well as plants that have been developed using mutational breeding, other not genetic engineering types of breeding, but still ones that have tweaked the genome of plants.
So you could hit a plant with radiation, and if it then produced seeds and they were different in some way, that would still be considered organic despite the process.
At this point in time, yes. Those varieties that were developed in the past 50 years using either radiation or chemicals to mutate the genes and develop new traits and varieties, yes, those are presently allowed in organic production.
So this approach sounds very scattershot. Do you know what you're going to get?
It is more random. In fact, the National Academy of Sciences and other scientific groups that have looked at this have concluded that these older methods of genetic alteration, including chemical and radiation mutagenesis, introduce more changes to the genome, and they're random changes that are not characterized than modern genetic technologies such as genetic engineering. The terminology is so confusing, even to scientists, right? So there's organic chemistry and there's inorganic chemistry, but that has nothing to do with whether a crop is certified organic. And everything we eat has been genetically altered using some method. And so what we try to do in our book is try to remove these kinds of labels. For example, GMO label is meaningless because everything is genetically modified in some way. And instead, we really want to focus on the goals of sustainable agriculture. How can we develop crops that use land and water more efficiently? How can we reduce the use of more harmful types of environmental inputs? How can we enhance food security? How can we enhance soil fertility, reduce soil erosion? These are really the important goals, and I think both of us feel it's just a distraction to focus on the technology with which the seed was developed, because there are so many different technologies, and there is no technology that is, for example, more dangerous or risky than another technology.
And the two of you in your book make the point that both modern plant genetic engineering and organic farming can both be focused on the same objective of sustainable agriculture and can work together.
Absolutely. They can theoretically work together, although there are some obstacles these days to actually making that happen.
But all farmers, whether they're organic farmer or conventional farmer or subsistence farmer, big farmer, small farmer, every farmer needs improved seed and good farming practices. So they always go together. You can't really have one without the other.
Pamela, you are known for having genetically engineered a rice plant that doesn't seem to be bothered spending long periods of time underwater. What is the significance of that to people?
Breeders have known for a long, long time that there was one ancient variety of rice that could withstand 2 weeks of flooding. And it's of great interest to farmers because in South and Southeast Asia, floods can occur very sporadically, and they can reduce rice yields dramatically. And this is a big problem for farmers in South and Southeast Asia who live on less than a dollar a day. It's estimated that 3 million tons of rice, enough to feed 30 million people, is lost every year to flooding. And that's because even though most rice varieties grow well in standing water, most rice varieties will die if they're submerged for more than 3 days. So geneticists and breeders at the International Rice Research Institute, including my colleague David McKill, were studying a variety that had a very unusual property, that it could withstand 2 weeks of complete submergence. So we collaborated to identify a gene that from this ancient variety that confers this tolerance, and Here at UC Davis, we were able to show through genetic engineering that we could add a single gene and have a really dramatic effect on the ability of the plant to withstand flooding. And I think even more importantly are the work of my collaborators at the International Rice Research Institute, who were able to use this genetic information to develop new rice varieties that have been distributed to farmers. And last year, 4 million farmers were growing this rice developed at the International Rice Research Institute called Sub-1 Rice. And those farmers are seeing about a threefold increase in yield compared to older varieties that cannot withstand flooding.
And because that gene that conferred submergence tolerance came from a rice plant, the plant breeders at International Rice Research Institute were able to bring that gene into commercial rice varieties using marker-assisted breeding. So although Pam proved the concept and developed the concept that that gene conferred submergence tolerance using genetic engineering in the field, the plant breeders are able to bring that trait into varieties that the farmers want to grow using marker-assisted selection, which is essentially conventional breeding using modern genetic techniques.
I mean, you actually tag the gene that you and you track where it goes.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yes, and it makes the breeding process much faster and also much more targeted than if you're just trying to identify offspring that that carry that trait, and you're planting out tens of thousands of possible candidates.
Though at the end of the day, you're using traditional plant breeding techniques, and so that plant is not considered genetically engineered.
That's correct.
Yeah, although I tend to avoid using the term traditional techniques because none of these techniques are not traditional. My colleague David McKill, who really initiated the marker-assisted breeding analysis, and his colleagues used very modern genetic fingerprinting to precisely introduce the gene. So the using traditional techniques, breeders failed to produce varieties that could be delivered to farmers because the farmers rejected the varieties because using older techniques, the new varieties may contain the gene for submergence tolerance, but they also carry a lot of traits that reduce the taste, the flavor, the productivity of that new variety. So it's really important to, in this case, that the breeders use modern genetic techniques to develop a locally adapted variety that was suitable for use by farmers in Bangladesh and India and other countries.
So if I can push on and stay with the rice plant, a story from a while ago called Golden Rice, beta-carotene engineered into a rice plant to address human health issues, I guess, more than anything else, is not as acceptable. So can you unpack that a little bit for us? What makes one so positive and one so apparently negative?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. I think for the farmers, golden rice is very positive. For children and consumers, it's very positive. So golden rice was developed by a talented group of scientists and breeders, initially funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, to aim to generate rice varieties that were enriched for the production of beta carotene, which is a precursor of vitamin A. And the reason this project was and still is so exciting is because there are something like 500,000 children that go blind every year because they don't have sufficient vitamin A in their diet, and half these children die. So it's a very grave problem, and I think it's something that we don't think so much about in the developed world because we have such a diversity of food products and vitamins everywhere. But when you're in a rural community where you're eating rice three times a day and you don't have access to diverse types of fruits and vegetables, where you don't have money to buy vitamins and things, it's a stark situation. So Golden Rice was developed with these children and young mothers in mind, and it's been very successful. Again, this is all in the public domain, nonprofit, and many tests have been carried out showing that thousands of lives will be saved for as soon as the Golden Rice is released. So there are groups that oppose any type of genetic engineering, and the only difference between Subone rice, for example, and Golden Rice, well, there's a lot of differences. So this is why I don't like the term GMO, because everything is genetically modified and every trait is different. So the submergence-tolerant rice is for subsistence farmers that are suffering from flooding and losing yield. So it's an environmental stress. Golden rice is nutritionally enhanced rice. One of the other differences is that Subone rice, the gene was introduced through marker-assisted breeding, whereas Golden rice, the gene comes from, one of the genes is from a bacteria and one is from corn. And even though chemically, it produces, as a chemist, you know that the beta carotene is identical that you would find in something like spinach. It has been opposed by primarily by Greenpeace, that are opposed to their concept of genetic engineering or their concept of GMOs. So it's a very grave situation for many children.
So Raul, as an organic farmer, you must come in contact with a lot of other people who are very pro-organic and quite possibly anti-GMO. Why would such people, with the best of intentions, be against something like Golden Rice?
Well, I can only surmise that they view it as a technology that's not going to work, that maybe they're afraid of it because it would be successful and it would be an example of how genetic engineering can help people. It's fascinating to me that it hasn't been allowed even to be tried, because in a funny way, you don't really know how successful it could be until, one, people start to grow it and people start to eat it and see if it becomes a functional part of people's diets, and it isn't going to be it's unlikely to be kind of a silver bullet solution. It seems like there are a package of strategies that include trying to get people to eat leafy greens or other vitamin A rich vegetables. There is a worldwide program to distribute vitamin A supplements to people, and some people can take advantage of that. And this would be just another tool that could be used to help solve this very serious problem. And the first two, the vegetables and the vitamin A supplements, haven't solved the problem. So it seems like in a humanitarian sense, to allow this other technology to be used would make a lot of sense.
And I think one thing that many people aren't aware of is that it's these are just simply rice seeds. So the farmers can grow them, they can self-pollinate, they can replant them, they can give them away, they can sell them. These are it really enhances local food security. So it provides and empowers that farmer to provide a better nutrition for their families. The problem with the vitamin A supplementation has been several fold, that it often these supplements don't reach rural communities. The farmers have to rely on external sources to provide the vitamin supplements. Some people don't like swallowing chemical pills. And it's also 40 times, something like 20 to 40 times more expensive distributing vitamin A supplements as compared to just planting a vitamin A-enriched crop.
So one of the things you mentioned about that with the Golden Rice is that it's in the public domain and it was really created by nonprofits. Most of the GMO that we seem to see, at least in this country, comes from Big Ag. And I wonder if there's a sense of again, this comes down to a language thing. Big ag is bad, therefore we're going to oppose anything that the big ag tries to do, and hence we're going to oppose GMO. And then that overflows into things which to me seem to be inherently positive, like golden rice. I can't see any possible downsides to that. So I wonder if either of you has any thoughts about how the political side, I guess, plays out in this sense, since it's big ag, which is often seen as the bully in the room in that sense.
This is really a complex issue in the sense that one of the things that these large seed companies have done in the last 20 years is they've bought up other smaller companies in the seed industry and really consolidated the number of people growing seed. So it's the control of the market is in the hands of fewer and fewer players. And this I think, does have a negative effect on diversity in the market and competition in the market. And some people associate this consolidation of the market with genetically engineered plants, but it's happening completely separately from genetic engineering. It's just a trend that's happened in the U.S., and there's a lot of patenting. People are worried about patenting plants and associate that with genetic engineering, but there are lots of genes and varieties that have been patented by companies that are not genetically engineered, and it's just an effort by those companies to maintain control of the market. And so I think this is a legitimate concern for people, but I also think that genetic engineering is not intrinsically part of that.
It's really helpful to just try to understand what fears somebody may have. Like, what I hear a lot is that I don't like corporations, so I don't like GMOs. Well, that is something that I can understand. I mean, we're all probably a little terrified when these major corporations seem to be controlling our lives, whether it's Google or Facebook or Apple. But we do use the technologies that are useful. And there are many plants that are not developed by seed companies. So the classic example is papaya. So papaya has been genetically engineered for resistance to a very devastating virus more than 20 years ago. And it was developed in the public domain and distributed freely to farmers. And even today, 20 years later, there's still no other way to control the disease. There's no organic method. There's no conventional method. There's nothing you can even spray if you wanted to that would be effective. And so it's been embraced widely. Most of the papaya we eat in California has been genetically engineered. And so I think breaking it down to different types of crops and farming system is really very helpful, because of course most people live far away from farms. I think something like only 1% of people in the United States are farmers. So we don't sort of have that generational knowledge about how food is grown and what challenges are faced by farmers. And even fewer people are plant biologists. And so we do have a challenge explaining the concepts of scientific consensus. And I think one thing that is very effective is not only to talk about crops on a case-by-case basis, but also discuss just in general, what is science and what does it mean that every major academic or professional society has concluded that the genetically engineered crops on the market are safe to eat. And those are the same organizations that many of us trust when it comes to issues such as global climate change. The key issue is that everything needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis, and this idea of generalizing about a seed technology or a farming system, it really doesn't work. It's not useful for advancing sustainable agriculture.
You can find all of our past episodes at podcast.distillations.org.
You can also find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher, or download our free app from Google Play or iTunes.
Our feature story was reported by Amy Mayer.
This show was produced and edited by Mariel Carr. For Distillations, I'm Michal Meyer.
And I'm Bob Kenworthy.
Thanks for listening.